You're listening to On Shifting Ground. I'm Ray Suarez. Since the beginning of the pandemic, World Affairs has focused much of its energy on creating these radio programs you listen to weekly. But as we feel more comfortable gathering in public spaces, World Affairs has hosted on-site programs in San Francisco so we can bring international voices and stories directly to our audience. In mid-April, I hosted a live event with BBC senior journalist Fawzia Takur. She's based in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. On this week's program, we'll share an excerpt from that conversation. Much of Takur's reporting is on the weaponization of mis- and disinformation by political strategists, and what the fight for truth in content, the struggle for credible reporting, looks like on the front lines of a deeply divided country. You might hear some uncomfortable parallels with the United States when it comes to trust, misinformation, and politics. Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's World Affairs program. I'm Ray Suarez. I'm the host of On Shifting Ground, which is produced by World Affairs. If you want to hear a journalist lament the state of affairs in the news business, that's easy. You only have to ask them, and you'll get an earful. But that's been true for decades. But now a convergence of unavoidable and unpredictable factors, crisis in the business model, rapid technological change, and the rising distrust of institutions have combined to create a crisis that threatens far more than whether reporters are happy with their work conditions or feel like they're being paid fairly. Nothing less than the future of information, the future of social trust, and the future of democracy is at stake. To its tremendous credit, the BBC now has a disinformation unit, and we're going to hear a lot more about it. Our guest, Fawzia Takur, is a senior journalist in that BBC unit. She's based in Abuja, Nigeria. We're going to talk about the critical work she's doing in a country that will have a lot to say about the future direction of Africa, not only as the largest population on the continent, but a country with a great deal of cultural clout. Fawzia, welcome to World Affairs.
Thank you so much for having me.
Particularly in the political sphere, the cultural sphere, what gets people going in Nigeria? What is there an incentive? If you want to stir the pot, if you want to raise the temperature, what do you inject into society's bloodstream in your country?
Well, first of all, Nigeria is a very diverse country. We have over 200 ethnicities, and it's a very, very religious country. You have the predominantly Christian South and the predominantly Muslim North. So that kind of governs whatever happens in Nigeria, political-wise, social-wise. And then our constitution, to some extent, is governed by those religious undertones, religious laws. And for anything to work well in Nigeria, religion has to be put into consideration. So when it comes to political appointments, when it comes to division of resources, all of that. So disinformation in Nigeria, of course, follows that trend. So because of the polarization when it comes to religion, that Christian-Muslim division, we see a lot of the use of emotive language, labeling, loaded language that alludes to religion, that alludes to ethnicity, that alludes to regionality, originalism. For example, in this election cycle, what we saw is an information overload where we see both sides using those loaded language, pitting one side against the other. And the ruling party is, our president is Muslim, his vice president is Christian. But then the elections came and the ruling party nominated a Muslim presidential candidate and a Muslim vice presidential candidate. And that kind of stirred the pot of religion and intolerance, which is very common in Nigeria. And before you know it, social media in Nigeria was rife with a lot of disinformation, a lot of false information, false narratives about the ruling party trying to Islamize the whole country, trying to marginalize the predominantly Southern Christian region. And that was just the dominant narrative. Everything that was discussed around that. We were not hearing conversations about what the presidential candidates were going to do when they're elected. Nobody was paying attention to the blueprint of the presidential candidates. Nobody was paying attention to what work they intend to do in terms of inflation, which is a major problem in the country. In terms of security, Nigeria is dealing with a lot of insecurity, kidnappings, extremism, religious extremism, Boko Haram, all of that. Nobody was talking about development of infrastructure. The whole narrative, the whole discussion on social media was tilted towards that polarization.
So somebody had an interest in the national conversation being about religion and ethnicity and regionalism rather than those issues. Did
Absolutely.
They win? Did they succeed in their effort to turn up the temperature and distract the voters of the country?
Oh, yes. The elections came with a lot of problems. We saw a lot of violence, ballot snatching, killings, arson. And I wouldn't say for sure if all of these that happened were fueled by what people saw online. But I mean, that was the only conversation that was going on, you know. And important to say is that in Nigeria, social media influences are an important aspect of the media. Just as someone would listen to the radio or read the newspaper, social media influences play a huge part. And we saw a lot of them doing that, fueling hate speech. We saw a lot of them just pushing narratives that were totally untrue and that were inciting. Actually, at a point, we saw social media influencers linking a presidential candidate to a terrorist organization. That's a very touchy subject anywhere in the world. And then we've seen social media influencers fabricating a story about a presidential candidate that was from a certain region being part of a drug cartel with no evidence of that. And then during the election, we saw the spread of misinformation about the Electoral Commission itself. People saying it has been compromised by certain presidential candidates and they let the server, there's the server where the election result is being collated, to be rigged and manipulated. And people believed that.
If people, for their own reasons, start to circulate information like this connection to a drug cartel or this association with a terrorist organization, is it sufficient for the national press, big newspapers, broadcasters in the most spoken regional languages, to get on and say, that's not true? Is that ever sufficient to put the fire out?
No, it's not. And the thing is, we have this saturation of microblogs, as they are called back home. Everyone is starting a news blog these days, whether a journalist or not. You know, they just pick on information they see anywhere. They go on social media, they see a message or a narrative that is being pushed, and it goes in their site. And before you know it, it's been spread all over. It goes on WhatsApp, it goes in text. But then it also spills offline. Not many people are on social media, but then the ones that are go to people that are not on social media and tell them, look, I saw this on social media. It appears so-and-so person was part of a drug gang or whatever. And then he tells the next person and he tells the next person. And before you know it, it's the dominant narrative that everyone is talking about. And we still listen to the radio a lot. Everyone in the morning is listening to the radio, whether in their car or on the phone. And you see radio stations picking up those false narratives that are on social media and making them the topic of discussion on their programs and letting people call in to say what they think about the topics. And that's how
And that reinforces the original story.
It reinforces the original story, and it spreads and spreads and spreads. And before you know it, it's all over, and everyone believes it's true.
So you have the problem, the challenge, not only of the original bad actor who is spreading malicious and false news, but thousands of willing co-conspirators who hand it on.
Absolutely. And sometimes it's actually deliberate from the actual spreaders, the actual people that fabricated the story. It's a deliberate tactic to amplify it, to make it go viral, not just on social media, but all over the country. So I did an investigation and I spoke to a whistleblower who is part of this ecosystem of a disinformation campaign. And what they told me is it's a strategy that they use. They implant people in Nigeria in religious settings, in the community where people gather, just to push that narrative, because that is their aim, that is their motivation. And they actually have media companies that are compromised, that are willing to receive money to do that for them.
There's got to be a way to confront these forces who have developed these tools, not necessarily to deceive the world. Mark Zuckerberg didn't sit down and figure out a way to make people believe falsehoods. He wants people who want to sell sneakers or computers to keep getting their ads in front of people who want to buy different things. But the tools of selling sneakers are now selling ideas. Are the platforms helping? Are the platforms taking this threat seriously and saying, okay, we understand that we're part of creating this problem?
They are to some extent, but I would say they can do more. One problem that we have seen in Nigeria is how the people that spread disinformation, misinformation, are able to bypass moderation on social media platforms using local languages, which I think social media platforms are not investing a lot in. They've also been able to bypass moderation through using their own fabricated languages. So they have, because they know they have a target audience, sometimes they're able to use certain words that their audience will understand, but Facebook might not understand, Twitter might not understand. So I think they are to some extent, but more needs to be done. Just recently, the only Twitter office in Africa, in Ghana, was shut down. And I know that's going to really affect moderation on the continent.
It is an amazing thing to hear somebody say, the only office in Africa was shut down. Over a billion people, more than 50 countries, and they said, well, we're going to shut that down.
I feel like social media platforms do not see disinformation, the spread of misinformation, as a big threat as we journalists see it. We as journalists, as fact checkers, we need to put in as much energy in debunking and fact checking misinformation as is put in spreading it. But I don't think it's something that is doable, because the energy and the resources and the motivation out there for them is huge compared to what we have to do. Because as journalists, we don't just sit and report on misinformation, disinformation. Well, except for people like me, who that's all we do. But then for other journalists who have to report on other things, who have to investigate other things, it's not doable. And that's putting a lot of strain in newsrooms. And editors are complaining that the plethora of misinformation and disinformation that they see is taking away their very good journalists that would be doing something else rather than reporting on misinformation and disinformation. And believe it or not, disinformation kills people. It harms people. It destroys societies and communities. And that's why we have to keep reporting it.
So quick final thoughts. What gives you hope, if anything, in terms of the battle to have an informed public, which is necessary to have a functioning democracy?
What gives me hope, I think, is the media knowing that we have a responsibility to present factual information. And by doing that, we also have a responsibility to see that we put people first before any other thing, and that we stay true to what we believe in and do not give in to the negativities. For me, coming from a country where we do not rank very high in the Press Freedom Index, it's important to know what comes first as far as my job is concerned.
Fawzia, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to On Shifting Ground, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from listeners like you. Today's episode was produced by Elise Manoukian, Sienna Barnes, and Andrew Stelzer. Special thanks to our programs team, Chris Dobson, Joy Koo, and Maya Kegley. It was mixed and mastered by Matteo Schimpf. Additional production and engineering were provided by Rob Spate. KQED's Jim Bennett is our technical supervisor. Jared Sport is our executive producer. Philip Yun is CEO of World Affairs. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for listening.